Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Brian Lynn, Katie Weaver, and Mernush Karimian Ainsworth. You will also hear What's Trending Today, and Jill Robbins and John Russell will bring you this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, a journalist from Azerbaijan was released from prison on Wednesday. Hadija Ismailova will now be permitted to serve her sentence at home. The country's Supreme Court also reduced her sentence from 7 years to just over 3 years. Ismailova is a reporter for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. She has won awards for her investigative journalism. In 2015, Ismailova was sentenced to prison on charges of tax evasion and abuse of power. Many think the charges were motivated by politics. John Lansing is the CEO and director of the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Lansing said her release was a positive development for the people of Azerbaijan and a step forward for press freedom. The U.S. State Department also welcomed news of Ismailova's release. A statement by Deputy Spokesman Mark Toner said the decision would strengthen the country of Azerbaijan and its relationship with the U.S. The statement also urged the Azerbaijani government to drop the remaining charges against her. Human rights groups echoed that idea. Human Rights Watch also called on the government of Azerbaijan to release other journalists and activists held on politically motivated charges.
A new report says former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton broke department rules by using private email to do government business. Clinton's use of private email has been an issue in her presidential campaign. Her critics say she has been dishonest. She has said she did nothing illegal. Clinton admits to making a mistake by not having two separate accounts, one for work and another for personal email. "I am sorry about that. I take responsibility," she said in a television interview last year. The 83-page report by the Inspector General said Clinton risked the security of official information when she stored email on a private server or equipment in her home. It also said the department would not have approved use of the server if security officials had known about it. Clinton provided 50,000 pages of official email as well as her personal server as part of the investigation. The report said she should have given all her official government email to the State Department. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said Clinton was not the only secretary to break the policies.
"We could have done a better job at preserving emails and records of secretaries of state and their senior staff going back, frankly, several administrations, so back to before Secretary Clinton. We recognize that.
Former Secretary of State Colin Powell also was criticized in the report for using personal email for government business. The report found that many employees use personal email accounts for official business, but it identified three officials who used it exclusively: Clinton, Powell, and a former ambassador to Kenya, Scott Gratian. Every time a new government report is released, the issue returns to the campaign discussion. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump quickly reacted Wednesday to the Inspector General's new report. "Crooked Hillary. Crooked Hillary. She's as crooked as they come," he said at a campaign rally. He later described the report as not so good. Rated by PolitiFact.com, Clinton speaks true or mostly true the majority of the time. Trump speaks false, mostly false, and pants on fire false the majority of the time. House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi defended Clinton. She said the report showed weaknesses in the system that included other high-ranking government officials. The report criticized the State Department for being slow to recognize and to manage effectively the legal requirements and cybersecurity risks of official email use. I'm Brian Lynn.
U.S. President Barack Obama said world leaders he has spoken with are rattled by presidential candidate Donald Trump. The president spoke to reporters in the Japanese city of Iseshima Thursday. He is in Japan for the meeting with other leaders of the G7. It is a group of the seven largest industrialized nations: Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, Britain, and the U.S. Obama said the world is paying close attention to the presidential election because the United States is at the heart of the international order. It is not the first time that the Democratic president has strongly criticized the Republican presidential candidate. Trump, a businessman, has made a number of controversial statements about U.S. and foreign issues. At one point, Trump called for possibly withdrawing U.S. forces from Japan and South Korea. He also suggested that Japan and South Korea be armed with nuclear weapons to balance the threat from North Korea. His comments caused a strong reaction in both countries. When Trump announced his candidacy, he angered Mexico by saying that immigrants from the country are bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. And he promised to build a wall to keep them out. In addition, Trump has called for banning Muslims from entering the U.S. On Thursday, Obama said his fellow leaders are, in his words, not sure how seriously to take some of his pronouncements. He added that Trump's comments display either ignorance of world affairs, or a cavalier attitude, or an interest in getting tweets and headlines. Before Trump's primary election victories, Obama had said he does not believe he will be president. Obama has questioned the businessman's judgment on foreign issues. Earlier this month, Obama referred to Trump's acting on television. He said, "This is not entertainment. This is not a reality show." During a speech before graduating students at Rutgers University in New Jersey, Obama said, "In politics and in life, ignorance is not a virtue." This brought a sharp reply from Trump. The businessman tweeted, "In politics and in life, ignorance is not a virtue. This is a primary reason that President Obama is the worst president in U.S. history." Traditionally, a sitting U.S. president does not generally comment on the presidential campaign that decides his successor. Some observers say it gives the appearance of interference with the democratic process. After the summit, Obama is to travel to the city of Hiroshima. The city is where a U.S. warplane dropped the first atomic bomb in 1945. Tens of thousands of civilians died in the blast. Obama will be the first U.S. president to visit the site. I'm Mario Ritter.
A decision made by a soldier during battle can have a national and international political, social, and cultural effect. When the decision is a poor one, it can damage the credibility of the operation. U.S. Army Colonel Philip J. Deppert works to help soldiers avoid tactical mistakes. Deppert is the commanding officer of the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. He told VOA that cultural education is a major part of the Institute's educational programs. Deppert said DLI is famous around the world for producing well-trained military linguists who understand both the language and the culture of a country. The United States, and specifically our military, understands that in order to be the best partner with all nations around the world, we not only have to understand the language, but the culture embedded with that as well, he said. About 3,500 soldiers, Marines, sailors, airmen, and civilians attend DLI. Their agencies pay for their study. Wherever there is a U.S. embassy, there is a U.S. military representative who trained at DLI. Air Force Major Braden Coleman is a foreign affairs officer. 6 months ago, he began learning the Urdu language at DLI in preparation for his deployment to the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. He said, "DLI is preparing me to work at the embassy and to help with relations, so I will be in the program for at least the next 4 years." The DLI has about 1,800 specially trained teachers. Almost all of them are native speakers of the language they teach. Isabella Christopher teaches her students the Urdu language and the culture of Pakistan. She has worked at DLI for about 5 years. She said, "If we tell someone that our students learn a language in 9 months, or 35 weeks, or 47 weeks, nobody believes that." In addition to native speakers, DLI students also learn from U.S. military teachers who are educated in languages. U.S. Army Sergeant Garrick Bartlett received 4 years of education in the Pashto language before he became a teacher at DLI. He said his primary role is to help bridge the gap between Pashto and English, coming from that of an English native speaker's background. DLI has separate schools that focus on different areas of the world. William Samir Al-Wahhab heads one of the Institute's Middle East schools. He said the training permits students to communicate on at least a basic level with people who live and work in the areas where they are deployed. Once the population feels that the soldiers are speaking their language, they will try to do the same thing and be very helpful, he said. Besides language training, students are also sent to what DLI calls the immersion facility. There, they experience possible real-life situations. They are not permitted to speak English. They wear local clothing and communicate in the target language. The Obama administration is broadening the U.S. military campaign against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria. U.S. Special Operations Forces are to advise local U.S. allies. DLI will likely play a major part in that effort. Colonel Deppert said DLI would not send students from the school unless it believes they are fully prepared. He said the training center can show proof of how well prepared its linguists are. He said the school has linguists right now in Japan, helping with earthquake relief in that country. I'm Katie Weaver.
President Barack Obama and his family will be moving to a mansion in Washington, D.C. after his term in office ends next January. Obama, his wife Michelle, and their two daughters plan to live in a 9-bedroom house in Kalorama, one of Washington's trendiest neighborhoods. The house is just 3 kilometers from the White House, where they now live. The Obamas already own a home in Chicago, Illinois. The President and First Lady announced earlier this year that they planned to stay in Washington until their younger daughter, Sasha, completes high school. Sasha attends the private Sidwell Friends School. Her older sister, Malia, will be graduating from the school in June. Malia plans to attend Harvard University in September of 2017. Kalorama is near Washington's Embassy Row, where many countries have embassies and other diplomatic offices. It also is close to the official home of U.S. vice presidents. The Obama administration has yet to make an official statement on the planned move. People close to the Obamas say that they will be renting the mansion, which is worth an estimated $5 million. How much they will pay is not yet known. Real estate experts say the average rate for similar properties is about $22,000 a month. The new Obama home was built in 1928 and is made of red brick. The mansion has large rooms, with 2,500 square meters of space. It has 8 1/2 bathrooms and 3 fireplaces. The property has a large terrace with formal gardens. The house also has enough parking space for up to 10 cars. President Obama once said that he is looking forward to the day when he can have the privacy and freedom he enjoyed before becoming president. With a house in Kalorama, he might just be able to do that. I'm Mehrnush Karimian Ainsworth.
This is What's Trending Today. Matt Pierce works for the Los Angeles Times. The newspaper sent him to Minneapolis, Minnesota, earlier this month to report on an event. One night, he had dinner at one of the city's Somali restaurants. Minneapolis has a large population of Somali refugees. Matt Pierce ordered a lamb and rice dish at the eatery. The server brought the food to him. He also brought a banana, something Pierce had not ordered. The reporter did not know what to do with the banana. He tweeted a photograph of his first ever Somali meal. He wrote on Twitter that the banana was brought as an appetizer. An appetizer is a small dish served before the main meal. As Pierce learned, the banana was not, in fact, an appetizer. Somali Twitter users quickly corrected him. In fact, bananas are an important part of any Somali meal. Somalis cut up the fruit and eat it over the rice. Twitter user Abdirahman Ali lives in Kenya. He explained that a rice without banana is not complete. I am Somali and I eat it daily. Banana is life. Thousands of people mocked Pierce on social media for not knowing what to do with the banana. Somali Twitter user Hiba wrote, "Man said the banana was brought in as an appetizer, like it's not the meal." Another Twitter user joked that anyone who goes to a Somali restaurant should know what to do with the banana. On Wednesday, Pierce wrote a story about his mistake for the Los Angeles Times. He admitted that although he likes to try new foods, he does not know very much about the food of different cultures. He added that the many comments he received showed the importance of the internet and social media for Somalis around the world. Somali millennials around the world, he wrote, were laughing at me, definitely not with me, for failing Somali Cuisine 101. It taught me about how food and the internet bring people in the Somali diaspora together. One Somali Twitter user wrote that this article is evidence to why Somali Twitter is the best. By Wednesday night in the U.S., Somali cuisine was the number one trending topic on Facebook. That same day, Pierce joked on Twitter about all the attention he has received from his banana mistake. He wrote, "Today I covered a Trump rally and was a trending banana idiot." And that's What's Trending Today.
From VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Have you ever wondered about the differences between the words this, that, these, and those? These words are called demonstratives. Demonstratives tell who or what you are talking about. They are often a source of confusion for English learners because other languages use demonstratives in different ways than English does. Demonstratives can act as pronouns or as determiners. A pronoun is a word that is used instead of a noun or noun phrase. A determiner is a word that comes before a noun and is used to show which thing is being referred to. In the second sentence of this story, you heard these as a determiner when I said, "These words are called demonstratives."
As pronouns, demonstratives identify or point to nouns. This points to an object that is near to you in space, thought, or time. The plural form of this is these. Here are two examples. This,
in my hand,
is my pen. These,
people standing near me,
are my friends. That points to an object that is comparatively far from you in space, thought, or time. The plural form of that is those. So, for example, you could say, that,
in your hand,
is your pen. Those,
people standing far from me,
are my friends. Demonstratives can serve as a signal for a noun phrase, or take the place of a noun phrase. Here are two examples. In the first example, these acts as a determiner, while in the second example, these acts as a pronoun.
These old tires and car parts will be perfect toys for the children. These will be perfect toys for the children.
Demonstratives are common in speech, writing, and even popular songs. For example, in My Favorite Things, a song from the famous film The Sound of Music, the singer lists the objects that she loves. In the last line, she refers to these objects by singing, "These are a few of my favorite things."
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
In the song, "these" refers to raindrops on roses, whiskers on kittens, kettles, mittens, and packages.
Determiners give information about whether a noun is general or specific. Demonstrative determiners tell you that the noun or noun phrase is specific. You use a specific determiner when you know that the person who is reading your writing or listening to you knows what you are referring to. In other words, you have a clear antecedent. In the song My Favorite Things, the antecedents are the objects that the singer lists before she says, "These are a few of my favorite things." In the book Rhetorical Grammar, Martha Cohn writes that if you do not use demonstratives to refer to a clear antecedent, such as a noun phrase, your writing loses clarity. Take, for example, the following sentence.
My friend just told me she is going to quit her job. That came as a surprise.
The subject of the second sentence, that, refers to the whole idea in the first sentence. When this or that refers to a broad idea, Cohn writes, you can usually improve your sentence by turning the pronoun into a determiner. In other words, you can use a complete noun phrase in place of the demonstrative pronoun. So, for example, you could improve your sentence by writing,
My friend just told me she is going to quit her job. That decision came as a surprise.
By adding a noun, such as decision, to the sentence, you can make it easier for your reader to understand what you are referring to. The next time you are writing or speaking, ask yourself if the demonstrative that you are using has a clear antecedent. If you have to think about it, then your reader or listener will probably have a difficult time understanding what you mean. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.